This is the American Ag Network Week in Review. In the show today, Rusty Halvorsen gets us caught up on the week's top news.
Trade negotiators from China and the U.S. resumed talks on Friday. The representatives posed for photos at a government guest house in western Beijing, but did not comment about the state of negotiations. China recently booked its largest U.S. corn purchase in at least 5.5 years, according to USDA. Tom Slate with the U.S. Grains Council.
You know, one of the things we'd be worried about is sort of, a courtesy purchase. You know, let's purchase some corn to buy some goodwill. I don't think it's too much of that, but that's always a part of the factor here. But, I think the bottom line on all of this is China is still a very significant importer of feed grain on the world marketplace, and they need the feed grain. So this, you know, U.S. corn was, priced well, depending whether or not you put the tariffs on. You have to do the math, but right now, the most expensive corn in China is domestically produced corn, so I think that we were in the market, and they decided to buy. Not much, but hopefully it's a sign of things to come.
The Trump administration and Chinese officials held their 8th round of trade talks in Beijing with several tough issues yet to be resolved.
You know, sort of the interesting part is what they say is that there's a very strong segment of Chinese economy and politics that is, you know, reform-minded. And a lot of these talks, you know, in terms of reforming some of the transparency issues with Chinese trade, making them more, you know, in line with international trading standards, these are things that there's a lot of folks within China that wanted to see. So in other words, the things that we're asking for are things that many in China are asking for. So I think that that's sort of the good part of all this. I think the other part is that, you know, China continues to want to have a better relationship with the United States, but they're not going to wait forever for this to happen. You saw that just happening here yesterday with Italy. So I think that, our folks are saying, you know, there's a lot of good will behind these talks, and a lot of folks want to see, U.S. return as a supplier of agricultural products to that country.
Chinese officials are expected to visit Washington, D.C. next week for further negotiations. Dave Salmonson with the American Farm Bureau says all eyes are on the China-U.S. talks.
Everybody has domestic constituencies, policies they want to uphold, where they stand in the world. You know, anything the U.S. and China does, the whole world watches, and more immediately, you might say, the respective countries' stock markets watch, of course, and the business community watches, and everybody watches. Our Congress is watching, and all of us in agriculture are watching very closely. Had an announcement at the end of last week that got a lot of attention from the ag side, particularly, and others, where the talk was about enforcement. How do you enforce a deal with China? Now, usually, when you're in a tariff situation, you'd say, well, okay, we have a deal. We have some things, mostly the U.S., what the U.S. wants China to do. We'll roll back or eliminate or at least roll back the tariffs that we have on you for now. But if you don't live up to your agreement, we'll put them back on. Well, then you had the president, I think, is putting out there as a negotiating tactic, probably saying, well, you know, maybe we won't do that. We'll keep the tariffs on China, at least some of them, for a while, and they have to live up to their agreements before we even think of reducing those. Well, that's, strikes a sensitive chord with ag exporters because the retaliation from China, of course, is on the tariffs that the U.S. put on China, on the retaliation on ag exports. So we're watching that very closely. I think it is a major point in these discussions. Especially from the U.S. side, what kind of enforcement mechanisms are included in any deal.
Meanwhile, the White House and business groups are stepping up efforts to win congressional approval for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. The White House's legislative affairs team has talked to more than 290 members of Congress and staff over the past couple of months to push that deal. Dave Salmonson.
There are obstacles have developed to this. Several things people talk about on the Hill, of course. You get people like Finance Committee Chairman Senator Grassley from Iowa, many others saying, you know, we want to see those steel and aluminum tariffs with Canada and Mexico dealt with, the retaliation gone, before we consider USMCA in Congress. So that's an issue that has to be dealt with. You get several people, especially on the union side, saying, Mexico agreed, and they did as part of USMCA, to pass labor provisions through their government this year. Basically, it was supposed to be done right about now, and I guess they're going to consider taking those up in the Mexican Congress soon. Minimum wage provisions, collective bargaining, things like that. So they're saying we got to wait on that. Other issues have come up, drug pricing, enforcement issues. So there are issues to be talked about and worked out with Congress before they can move on this. So this has both a procedural ways to go and some, you might say, political obstacles to hurdle before the Congress can take up this legislation. We hope sooner rather than later this year.
President Trump's top trade negotiator, Robert Lighthizer, told lawmakers during a recent congressional hearing that if they don't pass the trade agreement, the U.S. will have no credibility at all with future trading partners, including China. The U.S. trade deficit narrowed sharply in January, reflecting a slowing domestic economy and volatile trade dynamics with China. The trade deficit in goods and services shrank 15% from December to a seasonally adjusted $51.15 billion in January, that according to the Commerce Department this past Wednesday. That was quite a bit smaller than the $57 billion deficit forecast by economists. Lean hog futures on the CME were one of the leading performers among major financial asset classes in the first quarter, with futures rising by 29.4% through the 3 months ending Friday. The June lean hogs contract trails behind only gasoline, which rose 44%, and crude oil, which rose 30%. For hogs, a bullish second quarter and rest of the year is expected, as continued disease is expected to force China to buy more pork from the U.S., even with the 62% Chinese tariff on U.S. pork imports. USDA said U.S. exports of ethanol totaled 127.9 million gallons in January. That was up 45% from a year ago. The ongoing flooding being experienced in the Midwest is impacting rail travel. A number of ethanol production facilities idled operations after nearby rail lines became submerged. An initial report from Reuters estimated that 13% of ethanol production capacity in the U.S. was taken offline as a result of the flooding cutting off rail lines. Bob Dineen is the senior strategic advisor to the Renewable Fuels Association.
Most of our product, of course, moves by rail, and there are rail lines across the Midwest that are down, and that is certainly complicating things. As we look at production, though, we're a pretty resilient industry, and production was only down 3% last week. So there's certainly some impact, but the good news is prior to the flooding, we were looking at record stocks of ethanol across the country. So there shouldn't be any shortages. There shouldn't be any problems still being able to get ethanol blended gasoline. It's just, there'll be some logistical issues for a while that we'll work through.
But Dineen says the lost production due to flooding needs to be kept in perspective.
You might lose 10 or 20 million gallons of ethanol production at the end of the day as a consequence of this flooding. Well, that pales in comparison to the tsunami of lost production that we've endured as a consequence of EPA's unjustified waivers to the RFS, which are now at $2.6 billion, and we understand that Administrator Wheeler is contemplating another 41 waivers, and even if they're partial, it would have an impact far greater than what Mother Nature has wrought upon this industry, and that's just unconscionable.
Meanwhile, earlier this week, the Office of Government Ethics refused to certify one of the final financial disclosure reports of ex-EPA Chief Scott Pruitt. The ethics office said authorities never resolved whether Pruitt's cut-rate luxury condo deal in Washington, D.C. with a wife of a lobbyist was a legitimate business arrangement or an improper gift. The EPA's internal watchdog closed its probe of the condo deal earlier without ruling because investigators were unable to interview Pruitt after he resigned. The Senate Tuesday voted 0-57 against the non-binding Green New Deal resolution. No senator voted for it. 57 senators, including a handful of Democrats, voted against it. The remaining 43, all Democrats, voted present as a protest. Colin Woodall with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Well, you know what? It's kind of the best and worst of Washington, D.C., and the way that whole thing went down. I think when you sit back and look at what transpired, Senator Cornyn from Texas probably said it the best when he was on the floor speaking and said that any senator would be thrilled if the majority leader came to them and said, hey, I'm going to give you a vote on your resolution. But then those who sponsored the resolution decided that that wasn't good enough, and they claimed that the vote was going to be just a sham action on behalf of Republicans to make them look bad. So all of those who were supporting it and some of their additional cronies decided to vote no on the procedural vote. And that's what's interesting about this, is this was just on the cloture vote to end and go towards a vote on the Green New Deal. So they didn't even get to the point where they could vote on the Green New Deal because of the way that the Democrats handled this. So I think that shows that they're probably not all that serious about this. And when you sit back and you look at the Green New Deal and see how vague it is and how ridiculously constructed it is, you can see very quickly that that's not something that they should be proud of, and that's probably why they decided to kind of move back from this and distance themselves by voting no.
Democrats had asked Republican leadership to schedule hearings with experts and build broad support for a bipartisan solution before going straight to the floor. Speaking of climate issues, Mary Thomas Hart, the NCBA's Deputy Environmental Counsel, says a recent report from USDA's Agricultural Research Service showed that beef cattle are not a significant contributor to climate change.
The specific numbers we got were that cattle production contributes about 3.3% of overall greenhouse gas emissions. So we were really happy to see those numbers. And we'll certainly be taking those numbers to the Hill and through the countryside.
Some in agriculture have felt targeted by language included in the Green New Deal, and there's long been talk of belching cows contributing to greenhouse gas emissions.
I think one of the other things that this study does pretty well to clarify is that transportation and electricity generation make up about 56% of greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, cattle are being, you know, put under a microscope when we really only contribute a very small portion to the overall picture.
The Senate voted 90-10 to move forward to consideration of a $13.46 billion disaster aid package on Tuesday, but that plan will not address current flooding in the Midwest. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said disaster aid would get approved in piecemeal fashion as the number of disasters continues to grow. Colin Woodall with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You know, they are making some progress, and the good news is that we have been told that they will include some additional funds for the flooding. That is great news. We were concerned that maybe this was a little bit too far down the road looking at previous disasters, that they may not actually be able to cover the Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and the other states' issues in this package, but that's not going to be the case. They are going to get it done. Unfortunately, the holdup right now has to do with a little fight between the Democrats and the Republicans on the Senate side in terms of Puerto Rico hurricane relief. So if they can get over that, hopefully they can get this passed and have some additional monies available to producers there in the Midwest who are trying to recover.
Farmers are expected to plant 92.8 million acres of corn this spring, up 4% from last year, and recapturing the acreage title from soybeans for 2019. USDA released its prospective plantings report for 2019 on Friday. Soybean acreage is projected at 84.6 million acres, a 5% drop from last year. North Dakota, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana showing the highest percentage of change in corn acres, overall an increase of 4%. Soybean acreage in Iowa will decline 600,000 acres, 400,000 in North Dakota, 300,000 in Illinois.
This has been the American Ag Network Week in Review. I'm Sabrina Hill. For Rusty Halverson and myself, thanks for listening. Join us again next week.